Welcome to Tilted, a Lean In podcast. Tilted brings you conversations at the intersection of gender and culture. We dig into topics we're curious about, highlight people and stories that inspire us and we hope inspire you too, and share expert advice to help you make the playing field a little less tilted. I'm your host, Rachel Thomas, co-founder and CEO of Lean In. COVID-19 has brought America's childcare crisis into sharp relief. Millions of women are now struggling to work while caring for and, in many cases, homeschooling their kids. And according to our annual Women in the Workplace study with McKinsey, one in three mothers are now considering downshifting their careers or leaving the workforce due to the pandemic and issues with childcare. The long-term effects will be devastating to mothers, their families, and our economy. But in many ways, this is not a new crisis. Our childcare system was broken long before the pandemic, especially for single parents and low-income families, but for middle-class families too. Over the past two decades, the cost of childcare has more than doubled, while income has remained about the same. Just think about that for a minute. So today we talked to two women, both mothers and policy experts, from each side of the political aisle about the policies we need to build an affordable childcare system for families. First, I talked to Fatima Goss-Graves, president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, who has spent her career fighting for gender justice in the courts. She focuses on everyday issues in women's lives like childcare, income security, and workplace fairness. So to start, you know, when did you become so passionate about fighting for gender justice?
I have to say, I can't remember a time when I didn't feel passionately about fighting for gender justice, but from a very early age, I understood not just the opportunity, almost the duty in my life and in my family's life to seek to build a better world, a world that is more equal and just and fair and where all people can thrive.
And were you inspired by the work that your mother does? Which, could you share a little bit about that?
You know, my mom is a amazing inspiration. You know, growing up, she had a career both first as a social worker and then in philanthropy, mostly in Detroit, Michigan. She was ready to retire, but she was not ready to be still, which I think was really important. And so she built this project that she calls Warrior Women. And it is this joyful place where women who are sort of leading women in the state of Michigan basically are using all of their power and privilege and aligning themselves with women who are transitioning out of homelessness and all of the many barriers that we, for some reason, put in their way as they're trying to get housed and support their children and build new lives.
That's awesome. And I love that line, she didn't want to be still. I love that idea.
Well, I think that's actually coming up a lot for folks who are ready to transition, right? They're ready to retire. They have built these amazing careers. They're leaving legacies behind. But that doesn't mean that they're done.
That's amazing. So getting into the heart of the matter today, could you paint a picture of what mothers are grappling with right now?
I would like to say that our pandemic has just made a lot of things visible that were already happening. But the truth of the matter is, it has accelerated the pain that people are feeling in this country. And we're seeing it show up in the data where about 20% of women who were working a year ago are no longer working. And when you start looking deeply, just in the month of September, what we saw was 1.1 million people leave the workforce and not continuing to look for jobs, right? So this is not the people who may have lost their jobs and are continuing to looking. These are people who are not looking for work. And over 800,000, about 880,000 of them are women. We have never seen anything like this. And if you have young children, maybe it won't surprise you that September is when we saw those numbers, because that is when schools started up again virtually or in hybrid modes in different parts of the country. And that's when it became clear that women would continue to hold the lion's share of unpaid caregiving, of paid caregiving, but also continue to work. And it was not sustainable. You know, when I think about what we have learned in our language around essential work and essential workers this year, we have this new language that I really feel like is a gift to acknowledge the hard and critical jobs that people are doing that are disproportionately women in this country. 1 in 3 Black women and almost 1 in 3 Latino women are essential workers. They've been working throughout this pandemic, many times in conditions that are not safe and without things like premium pay and without our care infrastructure, which crumbled.
Yeah.
And so this period is one where we can see the short-term losses right now, but there will be long-term losses around women's wages and ability to accumulate anything that looks like wealth, around women's ability to actually sustain their careers, and around our cultural narratives and long-term penalties that I believe women are going to face as caregivers. I think we will see a new and sustained spike in how employers think about women in the workforce and all sorts of presumptions around them as caregivers, precisely because we're not treating this as an infrastructure problem. We're treating it still as a personal problem. So you're like either really good at solving your care challenges or you're not. And that's not how you treat infrastructure in this country.
One of the things that you talk about a lot in your work, and you just mentioned it, is the impact of this crisis on mostly women who work in childcare facilities. What does that look like? And also talk about what their experience was pre-COVID-19.
When I think about what our childcare infrastructure looked like, even before COVID, we should have frankly been embarrassed by the situation already. It was largely childcare providers who are running effectively shoestring businesses. They are paid so little. No one had any sort of nest egg to fall upon and get them through in this period. It meant that people couldn't keep their centers going and families frankly couldn't afford to pay. The thing is, we know that we are desperately in need of care and that that care, it actually has to look different. It has to look different in part because, hold on a second.
No problem.
My own care challenge.
Yeah, no, listen, that's real. That's what happens.
Sorry about that.
No, how old is he?
9.
9. Mm-hmm. Do you have more?
I have also a 12-year-old.
12, okay. Yeah. So mine are a bit older. And I'm grateful for every year because it comes with a little bit more agency and autonomy. Yeah. you were talking a bit about how the fact that childcare is privatized, it doesn't set the industry up for success, particularly in a moment like this. Could you pick that thread up?
The very private nature of our childcare infrastructure meant that it could not be successful because the truth of the matter is that we have built our childcare system off of the idea that it's just okay to pay a largely Black and Brown women workforce poverty wages. Childcare is actually expensive at a time where families had less, not more. They couldn't afford to pay more. The whole thing crumbled. This key infrastructure for our families and for our economies. Businesses were like, the biggest challenge we have right now is the fact that our workers have care challenges. The other thing about the pandemic was in order to actually support care, even initially just for the essential workforce, and let alone for others that were in need, in order to do that, what we actually needed to have in place was sort of different settings. People needed to be more socially distanced and farther apart. Providers could take fewer children safely. They needed PPE in a different way. They needed cleaning supplies in a different way. Instead, what happened, and it's frankly because we didn't invest, is that about 20% of providers closed. And I don't know that we'll get them back. I don't know that we'll get them back, in part because we've built the system on paying them poverty wages. There were some small business programs of which childcare providers barely participate in. You know, some folks who are technically running a business, they don't even think of themselves as running a business. They think of themselves as providing care because they love children. And their ability to access this program, it did not work in the same way. So there were other solutions, but we did not move them forward as a country. And it is a shame.
One of the stats from your research that really stuck with me, and this is pre-COVID-19, I believe, but was for a typical Black family, the average annual cost of center-based childcare for two children is 42% of their median income. That just left me breathless to think about what a big expense it is for that family, those families. Could you talk a little bit about, I know that COVID-19 has kind of blown up an already broken system.
That's right. Well, first of all, childcare is expensive. Yeah. It just is. But the other thing is that although childcare is expensive, it's expensive for a reason. It is a service built on caring for our youngest and most precious humans. There is not a way to do it and have quality that is free. And so the question is, how do you make childcare affordable? And the answer really, in part, involves an investment by our federal government and at a totally different scale. So that's one thing. The other thing is that childcare was hard to find. So as expensive as it is, if you talk to new parents, they're worried about childcare because of how expensive it is. They're also worried about childcare because they can't find it. They sit on waiting lists. They are desperate to get in. They know that there should be more, but they can't access. There are whole parts of the country where even before COVID, there were what people called childcare deserts, where you can't find childcare within a 50-mile radius. That has only expanded in this period. So when we think about the solutions ahead, we need an immediate investment to sort of stabilize the sector for sure and to solve the cliff that we are on where women especially are leaving the workforce in droves. We have to do that.
Honestly, my heart rate goes up just thinking about the anxiety of trying to find childcare. So you started to talk about solutions. Wave a magic wand for us. You get to paint what the future looks like.
I actually think we've laid out a plan that's super common sense that I feel like I shouldn't even need my magic wand for it. But I will say that we need a major immediate investment, and it's of the order of $50 billion. And I have to say that it took me a minute before I understood, okay, I actually have to start saying that number out loud and clear, in part so that people understand what it is going to cost and that they become a little bit unafraid of that level of investment. So that is one of the things. The second thing is childcare is a part of a broader understanding of our care economy. And I actually think one of the services that the new Biden-Harris administration can do is treat it as such, that they connect the conversation around care for childcare, around family leave, and around long-term care into one story around the care economy right now. And they can fully do that. I've already seen in the platform that they outline, they put the seeds of it there in a COVID relief package. I have to say that every time I look at the news and see the state of the negotiations, I am a little bit discouraged, but I also know there's a new opportunity with a new Congress and a new administration for them to get it right and provide the relief for that this country needs. In a first budget and in plans and conversations around infrastructure, care is infrastructure. And even learning that lesson. So, okay, we had to learn that lesson the totally hard way this year. Let's not let that lesson go to waste. Let's act. And so it's my hope that this will be a thing that's at the top of their agenda and that we see actual and fast action over the first couple of months.
You mentioned paid leave, which is an issue that I know we're both really passionate about. For people who are listening, paint a picture of what lack of paid leave does and link these topics together for listeners as well, because they are so intrinsically linked together.
So paid leave both for the birth of or adoption of a new child, but paid leave for our ability to care for family members and loved ones, and paid leave for our own self-care. And this pandemic has brought to light in extraordinary ways about why we need all of those things. People have needed paid leave because they found their loved ones get COVID and they had to take care of them. And so quickly in the COVID packages, we developed a program that solved for those different types of needs. The first time in our history that we had a national paid leave program, and it expires at the end of this year. So we're making some really on-purpose choices right now about our economy, our future, about how we want women and their families to thrive or not. And allowing the paid leave program to expire or the unemployment insurance program to expire during this wave of a pandemic would be totally outrageous, especially because what we've learned is it works, right? People took it. They needed it. It worked.
Yeah, that's right. You've talked a bit about what we need to do at the federal level. What are your recommendations for what companies can do, what the private sector can do now and into the future?
The thing is that the private sector doesn't have to wait for the federal government to get it together. And in fact, what we have seen is there have been a lot of important times where the private sector has led the way, and the proof points that they have, the demonstration that actually this is a thing that works, has been what has allowed the federal government to move forward. And that's been very true around things like paid leave. It's been true about accommodations for pregnant workers. It's been true about innovative equal pay strategies. So when I think about what companies can do, they can both do the thing that would have been required anyway, not because you're compelled to, but because you know it will help you retain your workforce, because you know that it will mean that you are able to keep your leading and rising stars with you at this company. And so we're seeing some companies do that. One of the big disappointments actually this year in the CARES Act was that it actually exempted, in terms of the paid leave provisions, employers that had 500 or more employees.
Yep.
And we can go back to exactly how that happened. We had hoped for something different. But what I will say is there were some really important employers who did it anyway. And that is important. Now, there were some who didn't and who made their workers work and whose workers worked even while sick, to the harm of the company and to the harm of the individual. Because frankly, if there's anything we've learned from COVID, is you do not want people who are either ill or around other people who are ill to be at work. That is a huge risk for your organization. So the fact that companies were not getting on board with that wasn't good. But a lot of companies just said, oh yeah, we're going to do it because they got it. And that is a thing that companies can do. And then they can talk about it. I think a lot of times corporate leaders underestimate the power of their voice to shift the public narrative and to sort of shift this town of Washington, D.C.
So sadly, childcare has become fairly politicized as an issue, as many issues that just seem so commonsensical and, you know, so core often do. How worried are you going into 2021? Like, is there enough of a shared vision on what a solution might be that you think we can get something through Congress?
I do think it's a little outrageous that it would be politicized right now. I'm hopeful, given the crises before us and the magnitude of the problem, that people will listen quite seriously to people in their communities. And what I do know is that across the political spectrum, across the types of rural, urban, suburban, across race, people are struggling around care right now. They're really, really struggling. And the childcare providers, they're struggling too. Sometimes you have to be able to cut through the noise and actually listen to the people. It may be that we encounter a range of challenges, especially in the Senate, which has so ground to a halt. I think the way to break through is with people in this country speaking out. Wherever you land in the political spectrum, the idea that a problem of this magnitude would just sit around without real solutions won't sit well with people.
That's a great segue to what can listeners do?
One of the things that has just been remarkable that has happened in this year is people have been sharing their childcare stories. They have been sharing them on social media. Some have been talking to reporters. They've been writing them in and sending them to members of Congress. Sharing your story does two things. One, it keeps the issue front and center, but it also reminds us all that we're not alone here, that what may feel like this individual challenge is actually the challenge that so many of your friends, neighbors, and strangers are experiencing too. But the second thing is, and I just don't know how to say it because I feel terrible about this, because I think people are exhausted right now. This year of 2020 has taken a toll. And what I would love to be able to do is just tell people, you can go relax now. Take your rest and we'll see you in a few years. And actually, my call to action is that people not let up and that they stay engaged. They stay demanding and willing to work for a different future.
And last question, you are running an organization that has always done mission critical work, but right now it just feels like it couldn't be any more critical. How are you hanging in there? You know,
I am not sure how I got through to almost the end of this year. I just am not. And I think it is the bright spots that we have noticed and experienced that have kept me going. Whether it was the moms and daughters basically building this remarkable shrine outside of the courthouse in honor of RBG, or the many ways in which people took to the streets for the first time in support of Black lives, or the many, many ways in which people came together. That feeling, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, we can't forget that feeling. We cannot forget what it took to come together quickly, because that's what's going to be necessary for us to come together in the future.
What Fatima said about people coming together to solve our childcare crisis struck me as spot on. We're going to need bipartisan support to make this happen. With that in mind, I next spoke to Dr. Angela Rashidi. She's a researcher at American Enterprise Institute, where she studies the effect of public policies and safety net programs on low-income families. To kick things off, I was just really interested in a little bit about you, because you've spent your entire career, you know, researching how to reduce poverty, improve family health, improve the well-being of children. And this must be a critically important moment in your career, you know, given everything that's going on. So could you just walk us through a little bit about why you're so interested in this and, you know, kind of how important this moment is?
It's a really good question. And given everything that's been going on, I think in one way, I've had a lot of time to reflect, given that things have slowed down and we have a lot of time. Very early in my career, I always had an interest in public service. So that's where my interest started. So even in college, I started going down the business route and then realized that profit making, while that was an interest to many people, that was of less interest to me. And I was really drawn to the public service side of things. And early in my career, social policy wasn't my focus. I actually started more on the public administration side, really interested in how you manage programs, whatever the program is, but just this idea of government needs to have competent people who know how to run things just like private business. And then I was fortunate after graduate school to have the opportunity to move to New York City and was lucky to land a job at the Department of Social Services in New York City. And that is really where my interest in serving low-income populations and low-income families really took off. I was thrown into the fire for sure, coming from a relatively small town. I went to a small college in Wisconsin, and just being thrown into the Department of Social Services in New York City, where we were serving 2 million people with food assistance, 500,000 people with cash assistance. And so just the scale and scope of the programs that I was involved in and studying were massive. And it really, I think, set me up very well to understand both the policy side of things, but I think that that early experience actually working in a program, interacting with families who were receiving government benefits, just completely opened my eyes to not only what they experience, but what government can do to help them, but also the many ways that government can actually be an impediment to their success.
Wow. Well, we're glad you're doing the work. So the goal today is to talk about childcare, but just zooming out for a minute, we know that American families, women in particular, are disproportionately impacted by the COVID-19 crisis. Just paint a picture of what's going on out there.
It's not very bright for women, that is for sure. I mean, there's been quite a bit of data that's been put out recently looking at labor force participation rates, for example, that really shows that women have been the hardest hit demographic group by far. And that's really different than what we've experienced in the past few recessions. So even if you just look at the most recent recession, that started in 2007, and even past recessions before that, it's usually men that experience higher unemployment rates for various reasons. And most of it is related to the type of jobs that men tend to have and just that they're more affected in economic downturns. But this, the pandemic recession, has just completely switched that. We are seeing, when you look at just labor force participation rates, and I think it's about 3.5% for women, or I should say for mothers, since February. And that's a very large decline from a percentage. It may not sound like a lot, but that's a lot of mothers who are completely out of the labor force. So these are not moms who are unemployed and who are looking for jobs. These are moms who have decided to completely leave the labor force. And women in general also have a slightly higher decline in labor force participation, but nowhere near what we've seen among mothers.
So the big question is, what do we do?
There's a lot of questions out there right now, not only what do we do, but do we need to do anything? So I think there's a certain camp of people who believe that this is just a temporary situation. You know, a vaccine is coming, childcare is going to get back online, schools are going to start again. It's just a short-term blip in terms of labor force participation for moms. And I can somewhat understand that, but we are 8 to 10 months into this, and that is quite a long time for mothers in particular to be out of the labor force. So then we have to turn to, well, okay, we do think that this is likely a problem and can have long-term negative effects, not only for women, but just for the economy in general. So then what do we need to do about it? And there's really two areas. One is clearly addressing the childcare challenges that families are receiving. Clearly, there's funding needs that childcare providers have. Some of these providers are not able to serve the number of children that they were able to serve prior to the pandemic because of increased requirements around spacing, cleanliness, all of those. So they need money to be able to do that. But I think it goes even beyond funding. I think it is a long-term problem in our childcare market that is overregulated and under-resourced. And so I think that this provides an opportunity not only to, in the short term, just increase funding so we can get some of these providers back online, but also just think more broadly and holistically about what government policies are in place that are actually preventing these childcare providers from being viable businesses. And so I would really like to see that happen and encourage policymakers to really think that through in the long term, because that's one way we're going to get moms in particular back into the labor force. And the other one is we just really have to solve this school issue. It's somewhat unconscionable that we still have large shares of schools across the country that are completely closed. Again, we've had a number of months guidance for local school districts and states to figure out how to open schools for children in a safe and useful way. And we just continually see very negative effects on children and on families of them being out of school. So I think that that is an imperative and something that needs to happen in the near term, meaning shortly after the first of the year, to get these remaining schools that are not online back online.
I have to confess, and you're so much closer to this than I am, I think that's a super complicated issue, whether schools open or not, just given that health is a front and center for so many of us right now. But one of the things that you touched on, which is there is a sense that there is some bipartisan support for addressing childcare, that maybe it's re-energized by the COVID-19 crisis. Do you think 2021 is a year where we actually see some legislation put in place to offer relief?
There is a lot of opportunity to relook at childcare assistance in this country. Childcare has long been a bipartisan issue. It's actually Republican presidents like George W. Bush, who expanded the child tax credit to address childcare. His father, George H.W. Bush, started the child care subsidy program. So, I mean, there's a long history of Republicans supporting child care programs. And there's a number of Republicans currently that have an interest in this issue and hear from their constituents about the trouble that families have affording high quality child care. So it definitely is an issue that is in the forefront of many policymakers' minds, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. I think where some of the sticking points are moving forward, though, is just what to do about the lack of affordable child care. That's where I think there's less agreement, but I still think there's opportunity for some compromises. So where the agreement tends to fall apart a little bit is, do you just provide more government assistance and just keep piling on the subsidies and going increasingly up the income scale and providing families with additional support, which is one approach. And the other approach is really to address the underlying issues of why child care is unaffordable. And from that perspective, you must take into account the regulations that are put on child care providers at the state level. And in many ways, these child care providers are overregulated and regulated in a way that has largely nothing to do with quality child care. So there's a need to really take a look at what government can do, not only to help families afford child care, but what they can do to help businesses be viable in the child care market without so much government control over what they're doing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And you kind of touched on this a little bit, but where do you think the most fertile ground for action is?
That's a really good question. So historically, there has been slightly more support for increasing the child care subsidy program. So this is the program that is targeted towards low-income families. And it is a subsidy that families get that they can then take and use with a child care provider. And they're pretty large subsidies. Many will argue not enough, but they cover most child care costs, which can range from $9,000 to $20,000 a year. The other approach is tax credits. And I've long been an advocate for using tax credits to support childcare assistance. And I think that you could even structure it in a way that you make it a transfer payment for those low-income families, even if they don't owe federal taxes, but providing that assistance through a tax credit instead of through a subsidy program. And the reason I find the tax credit attractive is because it provides families with a little bit more flexibility. Subsidies have to be used with a provider that accepts subsidies, whereas if you use a tax credit approach, it can be used for any child care that the family deems appropriate for them. So there's a lot of pros and cons, but to directly answer your question, I think there's probably more support for the subsidy program because it targets low-income families and it is a little bit more targeted and smaller.
Yeah, and if you can wave a magic wand, what do you want in terms of more benefits or more support for middle-class families?
Middle-class families do benefit from the existing child care and dependent tax credit, but it's not very large. And then they also can get the kind of a flexible spending type program for child care. But it really maxes out around, depending on your number of children, all that, around $5,000 a year. So it doesn't cover anywhere near the child care costs that families currently experience. So one approach is just to increase that, to make that larger for families so they can afford more of their child care costs. The issue with that, though, is that you're just kind of throwing money at a system that has some underlying issues in terms of cost controls, for example, and this problem of overregulation and what that does to costs. Sometimes, you know, you can obviously, like I said, address middle class families who need child care by just giving them more money. But I think that needs to be really be thought through very well to decide if that's just going to be a pass through to providers who then are charging them more, or if that is actually going to be helping families and helping them stay employed.
Got it. One of the things you said early is there's kind of two schools of thoughts right now, that this is putting an existing problem in high relief. And the other is that it's really a COVID-19 problem. It sounds like you're in the camp. I'm definitely in the camp of it's putting an existing problem in high relief. Is that right, first of all? And assuming that I'm right, that is how you see it. What did it look like before COVID-19?
Yeah, I am in agreement that it's kind of putting this issue into high relief. But I think that there is still a separate issue that's been raised by COVID-19. And it is the increased costs of doing business for a child care provider.
That's a good point. Yep.
Because I mean, in the ideal world, if their costs increase, they would pass those costs on to families and everybody would be able to address those costs. But they just can't do that right now because it was such an abrupt change. And also families are not in a position to take on those costs. So I think that it's a little bit unique in that sense and does call for more government intervention at this point than I probably normally would be comfortable with. But I think that the experience of families very much differs depending on where someone lives, as well as other characteristics of their household. Yeah. Where the real problems come into play is when you have people who are not in the urban areas and don't have a lot of access, so they're in either rural areas, or even we're seeing this in some suburban areas, where they maybe have childcare choices, they just don't have a lot of choices. One longstanding issue that I hope Congress and even the new Biden administration will address is this idea of supporting more family or in-home childcare providers, because they really are the solution for rural areas, for other areas where childcare facilities, it's just not a good business model for them to go into some of these areas, but in-home providers, it is. And that's where they need to take a look at the regulations, take a look at how those providers can be supported and provide care to families.
Yeah, switching gears for a second, and I don't mean to put you on a spot, but you're looking at this from an academic and intellectual or research perspective and as an expert, but you're also a mother yourself. What do you think when you go to bed at night and you think about the childcare crisis and what we're seeing in the labor market in terms of the impact of this on moms?
Good question. So I have 4 kids of my own and they are age 9 and under.
Wow.
And I have had my share of experience with childcare, schools, all of the above. And I will say one of the things that really got me interested in studying childcare policy was the experience I had after having my first son. So I was in New York City and I think there's just, when you're pregnant with your first child, there's this idea of, oh, I'm going to have my baby, I'm going to take a few months off, and then I'm just going to go back to work because I'm going to find childcare and go back to work. And then you start to realize that, oh, actually, there's not really childcare available. And as a parent, you have no control. You feel like you have no control and power because it is almost like you just have to take whatever's available because that's all that's available. And so over the years, this idea of taking power away from parents because of the system that we have. So I've always tried to focus on how do we change the system so it gives parents that power back. And then also something I don't think I realized before having children is just It's a very intense, financially difficult period, but it is a short-term period. Those kids, they do grow up. If we can figure out a way to provide some intense short-term assistance to those families when their kids are young, even find a way that they could pay it back later, because you're just in such a better position later in your career to pay some of that back.
Do you have thoughts on what companies can be doing better?
I actually think the private sector could play a much larger role. It's much easier for large employers to do this, and then large employers tend to be employers of professional people or people who are higher educated, so it doesn't necessarily help low-income families. But I do think that employers could play a much larger role in a few ways. One is just being an information source for families. And if you had an employer that treated childcare like other benefits, so HR departments provide information about lots of things, why can't they also provide information about childcare? Even small employers could form consortiums, for example, that identify childcare providers and might even provide support for childcare providers in the sense that they can match employees to childcare providers. I think employers could be very helpful. And just allowing families to be more flexible when they have childcare needs. I think we all heard over the summer about some employers were allowing more flexibility for families if they had children at home, and then some of the childless workers got upset with that and then they rolled it back. And it's clearly not a black and white issue, and there's a lot of feelings on all sides of it. But I think this idea of if you provided more leave and if you provided paid leave so that families didn't have to worry about losing income, but if you provided that leave to them to navigate these disruptions in childcare that they are experiencing, I think that could go a long way in helping families as well.
For those of you who can't see me, I smiled when Angela started to talk, even though there's nothing happy about any of these topics, because that's exactly where I wanted to go next. I know depending on where you work, whether it's corporate America or not corporate America or industry, it can look very different. Can you talk us through where the real gaps are in paid leave?
In the United States, leave policies are generally offered by the employer. So we don't have a national leave policy in any way. And about 9 states or cities have their own, but it certainly covers a small portion of workers with a public policy. We've largely left it to the private sector and to employers to provide opportunities for leave. And that can include leave for anything, whether it's vacation or one's own medical needs or family caretaking needs. And so what that has translated into is that workers who are higher educated or who work at businesses who can afford to provide leave are the ones who access it. We know that low-wage workers disproportionately do not receive leave. And that obviously became a very big issue during COVID because, one, especially in terms of medical needs, so this includes sick leave as well. I mean, you obviously don't want anybody coming to work who is sick. So the Families First Act, which Congress passed almost, you know, within weeks of the pandemic hitting, but it did provide a guaranteed paid leave for workers in small businesses. What we've seen, and this was part of our survey as well in the summer, is that there certainly was leave taking that happened. We found it was 1 in 5 workers had someone in their household take leave. So we knew that leave was happening. But I think what was more concerning is that 20% of workers said they needed to take leave and didn't take leave. That was a combination of people who needed to take leave for their own medical reasons or just they fear of going to work because of COVID, as well as the need to take leave for childcare reasons. Certainly a gap still exists. And I think that's a gap that should be concerning to us, especially during this time.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking because it's the employees who make the least amount of money, who get the least amount of paid leave, and then they're between a rock and a hard place, trying to decide whether they take the leave and can absorb the loss of income. What are your solutions on the paid leave front?
There's a pretty big push and a debate right now about whether we should have a federal paid leave policy. There have been quite a few proposals around that, and it really runs the spectrum between providing a full 12 weeks of paid leave once a year for medical reasons to care for an ill family member or parental leave. Then there's on the other spectrum as well, maybe we just provide a little bit of paid leave at a national level for people who just had a new child. I kind of fall in the middle. I participated in a paid leave work group that American Enterprise Institute in Brookings had put together. And I was always the one that raised some concerns about the impact on businesses if we have this very large federal guarantee for leave. And I think that my concern came from, we do have a system right now, like I said, 50 to 60% of workers are already getting leave from their employers, and many of them are very satisfied with their leave. So why would we completely replace that with a federal policy that, at least in my experience, government tends to not be as good at distributing these benefits as private employers. So from my perspective, it's how do we then fill the gap and how do we focus on those low-income workers? My perspective has always been we have a need for a federal policy. I just would like to see it targeted towards those workers who really need it.
Got it. What's the one thing you think that we could do that would have the most positive impact? And outside of COVID-19, just make work easier and more tenable for them?
Honestly, I do think it would be giving them tax credits for childcare and giving it to them in a way that they could get it monthly or quarterly. I think that if you relieve the anxiety around childcare, especially for low-income families and low-income moms, I think that that would go a long way towards increasing the stability of their employment.
Yeah, that really resonates. And it's really hard to ask this question, right? Because as an individual, it's hard to imagine how you're going to change company policy, how you're going to change government policies. But as individuals, is there anything that you recommend that we can do to make a difference and push some of these conversations forward?
Yes, I do actually. So as employees, I think that we all have a responsibility to make sure that the leadership in our workplaces understand the issues that families are facing and make it okay to understand those issues. Just again, personal experience, but I remember when I had my children, I went from working late at night to saying, no, I have to leave at 5 o'clock. And I remember at the time, I was going to leave at 5 o'clock no matter what. And I was in a position that I could do that. But I remember other people in my workplace feeling like they couldn't do that. And I think that really needs to start to change. And I think the only way that changes is if employees have that voice, but also if those in leadership positions start to change that cultural norm that values family and family life just as much as their work life. And just last thing, I think that's achieved by really leadership understanding that people and women in particular are more productive workers when they don't have anxiety and stress in their home life.
All of that really resonates. We conduct our Women in the Workplace study every year. And one of the things that I've been really inspired by, the obvious is leaders saying, or heads of HR, managers saying, I read it and it drove change. But what I really love is hearing employees say, I read it and I sent it to my manager. I sent it to my head of HR. I'm letting the data and the research do the work for me, because sometimes it's hard to raise your voice or, you know, pound your chest about some of these issues. So in the spirit of that, for people listening who want to find your most recent research and follow along as you're doing more research on these critical issues, where do they find that?
Yes. So I have a scholar page at AEI.org. So American Enterprise Institute.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your tremendous insights. You are incredibly knowledgeable on all of this. And then, you know, woman to woman, mom to mom, hang in there. After speaking to Fatima and Angela, it is so clear we need to address the childcare crisis head on. It's simply not right that so many parents don't have an affordable and high-quality place to leave their kids when they go to work. And we all get this, but the burden is falling on working mothers who too often have to choose between going full speed at their jobs or staying home with their kids. And no one should have to make that choice. We need real solutions. And we need a permanent shift in the way we value caregiving in this country. So let's all take Fatima and Angela's suggestions. If you're a parent and you have a story to tell, go to social media and tell it. And let's all speak out for the need for a better childcare solution. 2021 has got to be the year we change this. That's it for today's episode of Tilted. You can subscribe to Tilted on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher,
Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our executive producer is Sandy Smollins. And special thanks to Ali Bohr, Chelsea Paul, Kate Urban, Madison Long, and Nicole Roman from the Lean In team. And Caitlin Thompson, Ireland Meacham, Jacob Kramer Duffield, and Matt Noble at Audiation. I'm your host, Rachel Thomas, and I'll join you next time on Tilted. Audiation.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.